From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and a week of confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh began this morning, but not with the scheduled opening statements. Almost immediately after this morning's Judiciary Committee hearing was gaveled in by Chair Chuck Grassley, Democrats objected to the document dump late last night, 42,000 pages on Judge Kavanaugh's years as a lawyer and staff secretary in the George W. Bush administration. Democrats said they've been asking for these documents, but they didn't have time to read them. Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal repeatedly demanded that Grassley call a vote on a motion to adjourn the hearing.
Mr. Chairman, if there is no vote on this motion, which has been properly seconded and which could be given a vote in executive session, this process will be tainted and stained forever.
And then as Democrat after Democrat persisted with objections, Republicans such as Texas Senator John Cornyn pushed back.
I haven't been in as many confirmation hearings as some of my colleagues, but this is the first confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court justice I've seen, basically, according to mob rule.
Well, let's bring in NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
I know. What a morning. And a little background. The Democrats have been asking for 100,000 pages that was missing on Kavanaugh's work in the White House. They pointed to President Obama's decision when Elena Kagan was his nominee. She'd also spent time in a White House. Obama released the documents. Longtime Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy said of this morning's hearings, "This is not the Senate Judiciary Committee I saw when I came to the U.S. Senate." How are the two opposing sides going to see what happened?
Well, before we get into the documents, I just want to point out how rare it is for a Supreme Court hearing to start in this chaos. You had the Democrats interrupting the Republicans, and then on top of that, you had protester after protester interrupting the Democrats, all with different problems. But the Democratic complaint boils down to they feel like there are hundreds and thousands of documents that Brett Kavanaugh had a role in when he was in the Bush White House, and they've only seen a small fraction of them.
Yeah.
The President Bush's library has all the information. The National Archives do as well. But it's not the National Archives that has been going through this paper trail. It's a private lawyer representing the Bush administration going through this, and then the Trump administration going through it after that.
Well,
so Democrats say we just have no idea what we haven't seen.
I'm just going to jump in, Scott, to add to that the private lawyer who's representing the Bush administration also happens to be representing a lot of figures in the Mueller investigation of Russia, so it gets broader. But you spoke about the protesters. Here are some who are protesting that idea that so many thousands of pages have been withheld. And they were shouting over the committee chair, Chuck Grassley, who said that was proper. And he quoted a Supreme Court ruling on executive privilege. Let's listen.
Unless the president can give his advisors some assurance of confidentiality, a president could not expect to receive the full and frank submissions of facts and opinions upon which the effective discharge of his duties depends.
We can't quite understand it because what's the point he's trying to make?
So there's two things. Brett Kavanaugh first worked in the White House counsel's office. And from that job, all of the paperwork is being reviewed. And this hundreds of thousands of pages, but still not all of it is what's been made either public or made available to the committee. Then Brett Kavanaugh had a job called staff secretary, which doesn't sound that important, but it's incredibly important. It's basically, as Grassley put it, the inbox and outbox of a presidency. For several years, he received, distributed, had the president sign every important decision the Bush White House made. Incredibly important role, but there has been a decision by Senate Republicans not to look at any of that paperwork because of the executive privilege issue. And that's what Democrats say is unfair and does not give them a sense of what Brett Kavanaugh did in the White House.
Look, we got to a little bit of what the lawmakers hope to hear about this week. Here's California Democrat Dianne Feinstein outlining her concern that Brett Kavanaugh would overturn the abortion rights law, Roe v. Wade.
What women have won through Roe and a host of privacy cases, yet to be able to control their own reproductive system, to have basic privacy rights, really extraordinarily important to this side of the aisle. And I hope the other side of the aisle as well.
Scott Detrow, Brett Kavanaugh has told Susan Collins, for instance, that he thinks Roe v. Wade is settled law, but Democrats want to hear him say it was correctly decided. That they see that as a loophole. If he hasn't said that, he could still rule against. But we're hearing from people that he may not say anything at all. He may not answer at all.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. And you're certainly right. Susan Collins is a Republican but supports abortion rights. And she seemed very satisfied with that answer. But right after that meeting happened, Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, said settled law doesn't mean anything. The Supreme Court hears settled law all the time and then they unsettle it, as he put it. So Democrats are going to press him to say, was it the right decision? And I think based on what we're hearing from those earlier meetings, he's not going to answer that question.
Yeah. Well, we will be talking to you throughout the week as these hearings go on. Boy, what a morning, though. Scott Detrow, NPR congressional correspondent, thank you.
Talk soon.
In Chemnitz, Germany, tens of thousands of people attended a free concert last night to protest racism and xenophobia. The event was held in response to recent rallies by far-right protesters who sometimes turn violent. Mike Sanders is the BBC's World Service Europe editor in London. And Mike, what galvanized the people who turned out last night?
For the concert, I think it was a real effort to show that Chemnitz is not this kind of far-right stronghold that the outside world might have got the impression it was after the protests by the far-right the previous weekend. Now, these protests the previous weekend, the far-right ones, they were sparked by the stabbing of a German man in a street fight. Now, this happened at about 1 o'clock in the morning, or early on a Sunday morning, after a festival, and it could well be argued that drink was involved. But as far as the far right was concerned, it was immigrants who caused the fight, and indeed an Iraqi and a Syrian have been arrested in connection with that murder. And from that point on, the far right took to the channels of social media to make sure that they got their side fully mobilized, including football hooligans, known football hooligans who converged on Chemnitz for these protests. And initially they were very violent. They chased passers-by who looked foreign. They shouted insults at passers-by. They attacked the police. And so the concert was an effort really to reclaim the streets, if you like, from that kind of outburst of hatred.
As you say, they were trying to reclaim the streets. They have a hashtag, in fact, that they've employed. What is the hashtag?
The hashtag is in German, Wir sind mehr. Now, that means we are more. We are greater than you, and we are the people.
The question is, was that sentiment from the protesters correct? Because there have been neo-Nazi protests in Chemnitz. As you say, foreigners were reportedly hunted down in the streets. Neo-Nazis have been giving the Hitler salute. And this far-right Alternative for Germany party placed third in the national election last year. Is it growing in strength?
It is growing in strength to an extent. I think we have to be careful. Most Germans are still very wedded to the democratic ideals that the modern state is founded on. There is a significant proportion of the population that is disenchanted, especially after the wave of migration in 2015 when Angela Merkel said they had to accept migrants from Syria and Iraq, which were in turmoil.
Right, and they have. About 1 million refugees have come to Germany since then.
They have. And if you go to Germany, you will find refugees in most corners of the country, but in numbers that a lot of ordinary people would consider manageable. But there is a significant minority that feels unhappy about the presence of migrants, the feeling that they are in some way hijacking German culture, German Christian traditions, imposing their own values, things like the burqa, the veil, and indeed the Muslim religion. And that's why parties like AfD that campaign very strongly on an anti-immigration ticket are able to make such gains in elections.
This is the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party that you're talking about, the far-right party.
That's right.
Is the far-right sentiment that we're seeing in that party getting any kind of pushback from the government? Is there a belief that the government has been too passive when it comes to responding to far-right groups?
There certainly is a belief that it has been too passive. In fact, even conservative leaders in Saxony, where Chemnitz is, we're saying that we have been too slow in reacting to this far-right violence. the mainstream messages are always this is a country where we are tolerant, we accept outsiders, we accept our constitutional duty to take in refugees. And that's the message that the politicians do push. But in some ways, it doesn't get the kind of traction that the far-right message gets, because a lot of the far-right leaders are very eloquent and put their message across well. It has to be said, they are good media operators. A lot of the narrative historically has been about immigrants coming in and taking jobs from Germans that leave them worse off than they were 20 years ago. In fact, interestingly, a left-wing grouping, a new movement called Aufstehen, has been launched today precisely to reclaim that kind of argument from the far right, that it's the left really that will protect your interests of employment, better housing, and it's no good scapegoating the immigrants on those issues.
Mike Sanders, BBC World Service Europe editor. Thank you, Mike.
You're most welcome, Lisa.
When it comes to philanthropy, as counterintuitive as it sounds, smaller can be better. Giving USA, the country's annual report on philanthropy, found that over half of the $410 billion given last year, $286 billion came from individuals. Foundations are way behind that at $67 billion. So how do you start if you want to do small donations? Well, Ben and Donna Rosen say maybe join with others to make your dollars go further. Ben Rosen and his wife Donna have been on both ends of the giving spectrum. He's the former longtime head of Compaq, has donated millions to big causes, including funding a bioengineering center at Caltech after a 40-second elevator pitch. We want to hear about that. But now the Rosens have come up with a fundraising festival focusing on small gifts to places like homeless shelters and soup kitchens in Litchfield County, Connecticut, where they live. Ben and Donna Rosen now join us from their home. And Ben, I want to start with you. About that elevator pitch, we understand you've been on many boards, including one at Caltech. When you got on an elevator, someone got in behind you, and 40 seconds later, you and Donna agreed to build a biotech center. What happened in that elevator?
I held the elevator and in walked the provost of the university, Ed Stolper, and he said, "Ben, we have a new bioengineering center going up at Caltech, and we'd like you to get involved if it's of interest." And it was great interest, because my wife and I think this is one of the most promising ways to help society in the future is through new bioengineering solutions to our various maladies. And by the time the elevator reached, I think, the fourth floor, we had shaken hands on a donation.
Of $18 million.
It was.
Yeah, very generous of you. And yet I can hear people saying, "Oh, but how can I get in an elevator with the Rosens, you know, somewhere?" How did you and your wife move from those huge donations for big think projects to realizing that maybe somebody around the corner could use your help?
Well, the reason we switched is we ran out of money. We wanted to give all our money away while we were still alive. And I'm 85 years old. Of course, my wife is decades younger. But we still felt there were a lot of charitable needs of a different kind. So we decided to start a conference that would generate money by people paying for tickets to attend this every year. And we would give all the surplus proceeds to small charity, and these are organizations that cater and serve people in need. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to the large type of educational organizations and cultural organizations and medical organizations, we wanted to go to the little charities, the ones that are overlooked.
When you say we ran out of money, a lot of people are purposely giving away their money. Were you joking, though, when I read somewhere that you didn't expect to live this long and you gave your money away too soon? Is that true?
No, that's accurate.
Well, wait. Are you sorry that you gave away, you know, $18 million for biotech?
No, it's much better to enjoy the benefits and successes of philanthropy while you're alive than when you're dead.
So, Donna Rosen, I just have to ask you, did this come as a shock to you when, oh, wait, we've lived longer, in particular, your husband has lived longer than we thought we would, and these huge sums of money are gone? I'm just curious about it. I will never know that feeling. And so I'm just, was that a shock to you?
No, I don't think that was a shock. We are certainly have enjoyed a lot of prosperity in our lives, and we've been able to give significant amounts of money to philanthropies that we cherish and feel are doing the greater good. But I'm intending on Ben to live to be 120. You know, so,
well,
and I intend to be around for at least another 25 years. So
you will eke out an existence somehow, but the huge amounts that you were giving away are not there. And now, though, you are still giving money away, but with this new, it's called Kent Presents. It's a festival that's held at the private Kent School for a weekend in the summer. And as yes. your husband was explaining, tickets are sold to people who come. And then how does it work?
Yeah, so the attendees arrive. They're generally staying in the inns around the county. We try to engage as much community service and business as we can. And we've organized a conference that is described as intimate, friendly, gracious, and inspiring ideas at the highest level of conversations.
So the participants buy the tickets to come to this week-long conference. You have speakers. You involve the community with services, which right there's a little bit of a financial boon. And then that money yes. from those tickets is collected. Who does the money go to? How does the money get into the hands of agencies?
We set up a charitable giving committee. Ben and I do not serve on that committee. We asked a friend of ours who's quite well connected in this community to serve as the chairman of that board. He assembled social workers and clergy people from around Litchfield County. After the financial collapse in 2008, we became acutely aware of how this was starting to impact many of the marvelous people that live and work in Litchfield County and have been here for generations, and that there were services that were probably in need of being supported. Services such as women's support services, the huge issue with rehabilitation due to the opioid situation. These crises and crisis centers, they're struggling to survive. So we also hope by our gift would also encourage others to be aware of these charities as well.
So we should say that the festival, which was started in 2015, you know, as anything, it needs to grow. And you have both put monies in to keep it going. And last year, it gave $125,000, I think, to local charities. What are some of the groups you mentioned, Women's Support, Fighting the Opioid Epidemic? What were some of the other groups that received grants, and how big are they?
They range anywhere from $500 up to $10,000. Such things as the Corner Food Pantry, homeless shelters, counseling services for people who have mental health care problems, food for elderly, the Visiting Nurse Association, Literacy Volunteers, Youth Hockey, the Volunteer Fire Department.
Again, you are trying to keep a firewall between you and where the money goes. But have you met any of the recipients or heard from them?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And we get marvelous letters, tear-stained letters. It's very touching.
Hmm.
You know, it makes it far more meaningful.
Hmm. So, Ben Rosen, what's that like for you? I'm going to heap some more praise on you. Named by Computer World magazine in 1992, one of the 25 people who changed the world, credited with helping to shape the modern computer industry, backing more than 100 technology startups, including Compaq. You were the head of it for so long, but Lotus, Silicon Graphics. And maybe you're getting a letter, a handwritten letter from, you know, a food pantry. What's that like for you?
Well, first of all, it's gratifying because just thinking back over the last year, We, through this effort, were able to donate to 38 different charities. Donna mentioned some of them. Big Charity has complete visibility. Everybody knows the big charities. And I can now say that almost no one knows the small charities. So it's not just giving them money. It's giving them visibility. It's high on the gratification scale.
Well, in the most recent Kent Presents, you had former Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson, Elizabeth Sussman, a photography curator from the Whitney Museum of American Art, Leslie Stahl from 60 Minutes. You know, again, speaking to these people who pay for the tickets that fund the grants that are ultimately given out to people in your area. What can other people do? People who can't get Leslie Stahl to come in, how can people get together to do this?
Well, they can give directly to charities that they hear about. It's hard to get people to give to small charity because they don't hear of them. They don't know of them. And so what we've provided is a way that people can give to dozens at once and help lots at once. I don't recommend that everybody try to start a conference. It's a full-time job, and we're too old for full-time jobs, but we do it anyway.
Well, but I'm thinking, too, that people can maybe not have a conference, but maybe have a raffle. You know, maybe have a potluck supper with a raffle and then have a group that gives the money away so that money grows.
You're absolutely right. And as soon as they recognize that there's a need and that there are these charities, there are myriad different ways of doing it, whether individually or putting a group together to try to help these groups. You're right.
Yeah. That's Ben Rosen with his wife, Donna Rosen. They've gone from the world of huge donations in the tens of millions of dollars to figuring out ways to get, you know, just dollars into their local community. We'll link you to what they are doing with Kent Presents at hereandnow.org. Ben, Donna, thank you so much for speaking with us.
And thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your interest.
It's been fun reading up on Ben Rosen's career. He helped Steve Jobs and Mitch Kapoor, Lotus, get their funding. Reading an article on Ben Rosen from 1999, his very successful life is described as cake coated with an especially thick layer of frosting. Obviously, he and his wife had decided to cut that cake and share it.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a bi-weekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
When a boat needs to pass under a low bridge, the bridge has to get out of the way. A drawbridge rises on both ends so a boat can go under. A swing bridge pivots so the vessels can get by. These decades-old bridges don't operate automatically, though. As Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scale found out, they rely on a small group of bridge tenders who specialize in a peculiar and slow-moving job.
If you look up while driving over the Grand Avenue Swing Bridge in New Haven, you'll see a small house. Inside that house is a bridge tender. Some days, it's Maurice Little, and he's waiting patiently.
Some people don't want to do it because it's like a boring job because you're just sitting there all day waiting on a radio call.
Boats call when they want to pass, making sure those bridges open when needed. It's a lot of waiting.
My wife, she knows. She said, "Oh, your job is boring." No, it's not boring. I'm used to it. I enjoy my job.
Between radio calls, Little says he passes the time with a book or on his computer. His colleague Mike Dorsey says even though the job can be slow sometimes, bridge tenders perform a vital service.
Somebody has to be on these bridges at all times because Coast Guard might need to come through.
If there's an emergency on the river. And they're a commercial necessity, too. Oyster fishermen who travel the Quinnipiac River need those bridges open to farm in Long Island Sound. And then there are everyday boats, filled with summer hobbyists looking to pass time out on the ocean. I told Dorsey I wanted to go up into that curious house on the Grand Avenue Swing Bridge. Dorsey opens the gate and we climb a metal staircase buffeted by winds. As we walk, cars and buses breeze by underneath. The whole bridge shakes.
People don't usually, look up here. They just ride right through, not even knowing that we're up here. It's crazy.
Inside the house is a giant control panel with numbered switches, like one that turns traffic lights red. Another button drops a safety gate to block walkers and cars, and there are buttons to actually rotate the bridge. Grand Avenue became a swing bridge around 1896, so the process is not automated. Instead, it relies on the eye. Bridge tender Maurice Little remembers the first time he was in charge.
It was scary, because I started over here on Grand Avenue. You got to be able to line the streets and the lines up. After you watch and say, okay, I know I need to let the button go once the angle of the bridge hits right here, and then everything kind of lines itself up. But after that, it's a piece of cake.
Mike Dorsey asks if I want to see one more bridge. It's on Ferry Street, a 1940s drawbridge just a few hundred feet south. There, Dorsey introduces me to another colleague.
Johnson!
Bridge tender Mike Johnson. Johnson says tending to bridges can sometimes be slow, but it can also be peaceful, attuning him to nature.
In the winter, you get to see the sun set over near the cement tanks, and then in the summer, you get to see it set over New Haven, over the downtown area.
For the several hours I was out on the river, I only saw one call, an oysterman who was headed out to Long Island Sound and needed to pass through the Ferry Street Bridge. But Johnson says the slow days are okay.
I'm not stressed out every day, going home stressed out, and this definitely takes that edge off, which is, these days, it's something to be said about.
As I left, Johnson headed back to his tower, anticipating the next radio call. Until then, he'll watch the horizon and he'll wait. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
Patrick's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative.
Back to today's top story, the Senate confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. He hasn't spoken yet, but in written remarks released in advance of the hearings, he said a good judge must be an umpire, a neutral and impartial arbiter who favors no litigant or policy. And I don't decide cases based on personal or policy preferences. I'm not a pro-prosecution or pro-defense judge. I'm a pro-law judge. Brett Kavanaugh was also a longtime member of the Conservative Federalist Society, which helped engineer his nomination. The society was formed in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. They advocate for originalism, a strict reading of the Constitution. They oppose judicial activism and the expansion of what they call the administrative state, the agencies that make up the government. So let's get a Federalist's view. Jonathan Adler is a professor of law and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. He's also a member of the Federalist Society. Professor Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And good to have you and have your voice. And what do you say to those who are hearing Brett Kavanaugh say, I don't decide based on policy preferences. I favor no policy. When he was a member of the Federalist Society, known to be against, again, this thinking of an administrative state, too much bureaucracy, too much power in the hands of government agencies, you write that his concerns about the so-called regulatory state shouldn't be misinterpreted as hostility to regulation. Why not?
Well, because in our system of government, what we call the administrative state or federal regulatory agencies only have that power which Congress has given to them in various statutes. And Judge Kavanaugh, over his 12 years on the D.C. Circuit, has shown that he takes these principles very seriously. He wants to make sure that agencies are playing by the rules. But he's also made clear that so long as agencies play by the rules that Congress has given them, it's not the place of a judge to decide whether or not they like the particular policy at issue. What matters is that the agency is acting within its legal authority and following the procedural requirements that Congress has set forth.
Well, but as you know, there are rules, including one, and I don't want to dive too deep into this, but the Chevron Doctrine, which says that agencies' interpretations of statutes they administer can get some deference from the courts. In other words, they have some leeway, and they should be given some leeway. Many people believe that's true when it comes to environmental protection and other things, that there is a fear that a Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh will roll back.
What we've seen from Judge Kavanaugh's record is that he's a strict grader. He doesn't give agencies an easy pass. But that's true when agencies want to regulate more, And it's also true when they want to regulate less. Doctrines like the Chevron Doctrine are premised on the idea that in some cases, Congress has delegated the power to the agency to resolve an ambiguity, to fill a gap in a regulatory scheme or something like that. And Judge Kavanaugh is one of those judges that takes that starting premise very seriously. Before he defers to an agency, he wants to know that Congress has given that authority to the agency.
Well, especially coupled, though, with this White House, which it's obvious has had its agency heads rolling back regulations from previous administrations. And then there was that memo he's bound to be asked about from the White House that said that Judge Kavanaugh has overruled federal agency action 75 times. It feels a little, I don't know, disingenuous to say that that may not be his goal, given that, you know, he was a member of the Conservative Federalist Society, the society backs him, and as Max Boot writes in the Washington Post, few people, including the president, are interested in judicial philosophy. They're interested in political outcomes. On the one hand, the Federalist Society is against an activist judge. On the other hand, seems to have wanted a judge in place who would be an activist and would roll back regulations.
Well, I'd say two things. First, I think it's notable that in 12 years on the D.C. Circuit, in participating in somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 cases or so, Judge Kavanaugh has been reversed once. And we've seen many of his opinions, including many of his dissents, embraced by the Supreme Court. More broadly, one of the whole reasons we give justices life tenure is because we understand that the political process tends to focus on specific policy outcomes, but that we want judges not to focus on the policy outcomes, but instead to focus on broader principles of law.
Well, you do point to the fact that he wants to follow the law, but he has followed his heart. I'm thinking of the 2014 case over a mining company in West Virginia and whether or not that mining company could keep the permits that allowed it to dump mining waste in streams. The majority on the court decided that the EPA could rescind the permits for the dumping because of the environmental harm. Kavanaugh disagreed. He wrote that the EPA never considered the cost to humans, to coal miners and shareholders in the mining company. Why shouldn't we conclude from that, that this is not a by the book, but a by the preference decision?
First of all, it is a longstanding principle of administrative law that an agency has to engage in reasoned decision-making. And part of reasoned decision-making is evaluating the likely effects of what the agency is doing. And since that decision, the Supreme Court decided in an opinion that affirmed one of Brett Kavanaugh's opinions below that that includes consideration of costs of what agencies do. And that it's not a question of whether or not the agency reached the right result, but we want to make sure that agencies who are headed by individuals who don't stand for election are in fact looking at all of the questions that they should. I would also note we can find lots of other decisions in which Judge Kavanaugh voted to uphold agency actions. We can find opinions in which he voted to, for example, uphold the EPA over the dissent of some of his other colleagues on the D.C. Circuit. So, in his 12 years on the bench, we see decisions in favor of regulators. We see decisions against regulators. What we also see, though, are a lot of decisions that the Supreme Court has endorsed and embraced.
Well, Jonathan Adler, again, a professor of law and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University of Law, and also a member of the Federalist Society. What would you like to hear nominee Kavanaugh ask today?
I would like to hear him asked about his judicial philosophy and how he applies that judicial philosophy to the cases before him. Too often, senators are trying to play gotcha and trying to get a judicial nominee to say how they would rule in a particular case or on a particular issue. And a judicial nominee can't answer that sort of question. But the sorts of questions they can answer are about how they balance competing authorities, how they interpret a legal text, and how they apply their judicial philosophy.
But as you know, non-lawyers are interested in direct questions about direct cases. They just want to know, you know, how might you rule? And how would you like him to answer the questions? He's bound to be asked about Roe v. Wade. He has said, he told Senator Collins, Susan Collins, that he felt that Roe v. Wade was settled law. But many abortion rights activists don't think that's enough. They think he should be asked whether he felt it was a correctly achieved decision. They feel that unless he says that, they're not sure he's going to work to overturn it. What do you think he should answer to that question? Does he think it was correctly achieved?
I think that's the sort of question he should decline to answer. Senators,
because then you feel he'd have to recuse himself if he actually was asked that on the bench?
It would create that risk. And, you know, every party before the court is entitled to an unbiased court. And when asked, especially in the context of the confirmation process, to give that kind of answer, it easily leads to the territory of only the right answer gets you confirmed. And that creates a sort of conflict of interest for a judge that's really inappropriate.
And it's pretty likely that he is going to be confirmed. How do you feel about that?
My own view is that when a president nominates a qualified individual to the Supreme Court, they should be confirmed. I feel the same way about lower courts. I think Brett Kavanaugh is eminently qualified for the Supreme Court. I hope he gets confirmed. And I would like to think that going forward, all highly qualified nominees of all presidents would get the same sort of consideration and confirmation.
There is some irony that in his remarks, he is complimenting his Chief Justice on his district court, who's Merrick Garland, who didn't get the opportunity.
Merrick Garland is a fine jurist. You know, it's unfortunate that the judicial confirmation wars got to the point where someone of his caliber, character, and qualifications wouldn't get the sort of consideration that judicial nominees should get.
Yeah.
It's a travesty that I certainly hope we don't see repeated in the future.
Jonathan Adler, professor of law, director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law, and a member of the Federalist Society. Professor Adler, thank you so much.
Sure thing, my pleasure.
We'll be hearing from different voices all week. What's a question you want to ask? Let us know here in the public.
Tomorrow, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg and Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey will testify on Capitol Hill. They'll answer questions at a Senate hearing on what they're doing to stop the spread of misinformation on social media. And then Dorsey will testify in the House on how Twitter handles harassment and hate speech and on whether the platform limits conservative viewpoints. Tony Rahm is following the concerns around these social media captains and how they're operating. He is the Washington Post's technology policy reporter. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So last fall, Facebook, Twitter, and Google all revealed that Russian operators had placed ads and content on social media to foment discord over issues such as gun control and immigration and attempting to influence the 2016 presidential election. Last month, Facebook and Twitter said that they removed hundreds of pages and groups and accounts that originated in Russia and even in Iran. Do lawmakers on Capitol Hill have faith that the social media companies are truly working to prevent this kind of thing?
Yeah, there's fear, and it's bipartisan fear. Democrats and Republicans alike who want to know if Facebook, Google, and Twitter have done enough to ensure that the same sorts of things that we saw during the 2016 election don't hurt Americans, don't hurt social media networks ahead of the 2018 midterms, which are just a few months away.
So,
and as you said, companies have pointed out instances of this disinformation being spread just within the past few weeks.
And then what is, for instance, Facebook doing to shut down disinformation?
Yeah, what those companies are doing to combat this problem. And each of those companies, Facebook and Twitter, has said that they've hired more people, that they've invested more in artificial intelligence to spot and take down offensive content. But when I spoke with Senator Mark Warner, who's the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee that's holding the hearing, he told me that, yeah, sure, these tech companies have done more, but that the adversaries, countries like Russia, have also become more sophisticated, hence the oversight that we're seeing this week.
What about Twitter? Let's talk about Jack Dorsey's testimony tomorrow in the House. Some Republicans say that Twitter is stifling conservative viewpoints. Talk more about what Twitter is or is not doing.
Yeah, it's not just some Republicans. It's the president of the United States who's come out and said that social media companies writ large are biased against conservatives. Now, we should point out that there's no evidence of systemic bias at these tech companies. It's not like they've set out to harm conservatives or mute their viewpoints. But there have been a few incidents that have bothered Republicans, such as lawmakers whose tweets have been taken down, perhaps erroneously. And so you can expect to see Republicans really push Dorsey on this point. And I should point out, this is politics in the making. Again, with the 2018 2016 election drawing closer, Republicans have used this as a rallying cry to get voters to donate. Even President Trump himself has used this as a campaign pitch. So expect to see a lot of heated debate on the Energy and Commerce Committee tomorrow.
And what is Twitter saying about how it does decide who should be kicked off a site for harassment or hate speech or any other kind of content?
Yeah, well, Twitter, like its peers, admits that San Francisco, the area that it calls home, does tend to lean liberal and that it's doing as much as it can to reach and understand the needs of its conservative users. But they've really all pushed back against this belief, this argument that they're biased against conservatives writ large. And so Dorsey has been making the rounds lately, meeting with Republican lawmakers, meeting with conservative pundits and so forth, to really try to make this point directly. And I should add that Democrats in all this have completely shut down this hearing. They've said that they think the entire thing is a hoax. They think that Republicans should be focusing on other more serious issues instead of bias allegations.
The allegations that Twitter, for instance, is stifling conservative views. I mean, Democrats aren't saying that that they believe there should not be any kind of discussion about fomenting discord over certain issues from foreign governments or foreign entities.
Absolutely. Democrats would like to see more hearings about Russian interference or about more broadly issues around algorithms, those powerful lines of code that determine what you do and don't see on a site like Facebook, Google, or Twitter. And you'll notice I mentioned Google there. That's sort of an interesting side story in all of this, where Google had been invited to testify this week, particularly in the Senate at its hearing on foreign interference. Google ultimately opted to send or offered to send a lower-level executive, but Senate lawmakers there rejected that. They wanted the CEO or nobody else. So Google might be the subject of an empty chair, so to speak, at the hearing in the Senate tomorrow.
You mean it really has no plans to send anybody?
Well, they wanted to send Kent Walker, who's their senior vice president of global affairs. But, you know, members of Congress from both parties wanted to see Larry Page, the head of Google's parent company called Alphabet, or Sundar Pichai, who runs Google specifically, come and testify. Google said it didn't want to send either of them. Walker is going to be in the audience, it seems. But, you know, Democrats and Republicans say that they really should have sent a CEO instead.
What's behind that, though? I mean, if other social media companies are sending their CEOs, then why not Google? Can it afford to take that chance?
Well, Google has done this many times in the past. It's usually opted to send somebody else other than Page or Pichai to come testify. And for many years, that person was Eric Schmidt, who is the executive chairman of Google. But Schmidt has moved on. There's a new executive chairman. And in the eyes of Google, Kent Walker, who's their senior vice president, is sort of their political ambassador now. They see him as the expert on these policy and politics issues. So in their minds, Walker is the best person to testify. But Democrats and Republicans alike just don't like that idea. The one thing that's managed to unite people around here is a frustration that Google hasn't sent a CEO.
Briefly, do you expect any kind of changes to come from these hearings, changes in the industry?
Well, I think you can expect to see lawmakers threaten a lot of regulation. But I got to tell you, we have this conversation a lot. There's a demand for Silicon Valley companies to do better and calls for new laws to address this matter. But often that doesn't result in much.
All right. Tony Rom covers technology policy at The Washington Post. Tony, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.